is the Grinion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grinion Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grailian Bunker, my friends, you know what time it is? It is time for another week of weirdness, wildness, and wonder. That's right, I'm Mike Hanks, the mouth of the South, and you've locked into the Grailian Report, your weekly hub for the strange and the unusual. Joining me live in studio, the man with the happiest face in radio, sitting across from me on the master console here at Grailian International Headquarters, co-host of the program and producer extraordinaire, Mr. Chris Hayes. How are you this evening, Chris?
I'm well tonight, Micah. I'm well. I hope you're sore, but well.
Sore, but well. Well, sore to okay, I guess, maybe. Is that code?
No, it's I'm actually sore. I just got done putting down another small handle rebellion. It's a never-ending process.
Like physically sore or
like sore, like S-O-R-E.
I thought
sore,
he lifted
physically. I'm not sore at you.
I think our zombified producer actually lifted a 3,000-pound net of crabs above his head today.
The man, just to prove he could do it.
Just to prove he could do it. Yes, and the man here behind the console, the Reverend with the kind eyes, Mr. Matthew Oakley. Matthew, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me. You didn't really have a choice this week because I just kind of showed up and, you know, like well, 6 months ago and stayed in the bunker, but, you know.
We'll give you some work to do. And as a matter of fact, we're going to give our producer some work to do just to give you a little bit of a taste of the kind of stuff that we're going to be talking about this week on the program. And speaking of talking, you know, during hour two, we're going to be gathering around the campfire a bit, so to speak. That's right. None other than Mr. Jim Harold of the Paranormal Podcast. He's going to be our guest tonight, and we're going to be telling some campfire stories and then having a general discussion about the paranormal after that. But what is this story of this mystery beast that I've just handed to our engineer here on the program tonight?
I just see two keywords that I'm already intrigued with, and those are donkey devil.
Yes, exactly. Yes, we're going to talk about the donkey devil of Asheville and various other things tonight on the program. In addition to, we're going to get a brief update on this. You remember the Baltic Sea UFO? Now, they call it a UFO, but this thing, I'll tell you, although it is unidentified, it is certainly not flying. It is submerged beneath the Baltic Sea, and this object, whatever it is down there. Ocean X was the name of the company that managed to find this, and they sent a dive team down. We have an update about that, in addition to an entire host of other things we'll be talking about tonight on the program. Strange mirror phenomena, the mystery of why pigeons are disappearing in an area that is being called as a sort of Bermuda Triangle. And a few other things as well. We might even get to a sort of a top 10. We haven't done a top 10 in a very long time, but Nick Redfern provided one this week that we may just have to dig into. But first, going to the listener emails, Mark writes, "Dear Micah, greetings from Scotland." You know what, Mark? I'm going to be in Scotland. We'll be in Edinburgh, well, about this time next year. Indeed. Yes, my friend Yari Mikkola is putting on a large symposium there in Edinburgh next year, and hopefully we'll all be over there at that. So Mark writes from Scotland. He says, "I've been listening now for a few months to the Grailian Report. I think it's excellent. However, it took me a few episodes to get used to your accent. It really reminds me of a guy who is on Radio 2 in the United Kingdom who impersonates Elvis. I enclosed a link for you to listen to. However, I'm now getting used to your accent, and I no longer expect you to say funny things at the end of every single sentence anymore. No offense meant. Keep up the good work, Mark."
So is Mark saying we're not funny? Is that he's come to expect that we're not funny anymore?
I'm a bit shook up. In fact, I'm all shook up, Chris. I really don't know what to think of that. Well,
wow,
I'll tell you this.
Just you're just pandering now, Matt. You're pandering.
Well, I'll tell you this. Recently, I went to a restaurant, in fact, last night. And while I was in the restaurant, the folks said, "You're not from around here, are you?" And I said, "Well, darling, where do you think I'm from?" And she says, "You got to be from Texas." I said, "Yeah, I get that a lot, slick." Oh, yeah, they do. Everyone thinks I'm from Texas, which is funny because I'm from right here in the Twin Cities of Inca Candler in western North Carolina. Yes, that's colloquial speak right there, Mr. Hayes, the Twin Cities. You know, we're going to be in the real Twin Cities this October for the Paradigm Symposium, of course, but that is a whole different story altogether. We'll get to that a little later. Another story written along or written to us, Damien writes, "I was writing just to tell you a story from back when I was about 6 years old. Now, I was living in an apartment complex in Dayton, Ohio, and right behind my apartment there, there was a courtyard and there was a small playground that I used to play in. But one day I'd gotten up early and my mother was still in bed. I went out to the playground and was doing my six-year-old thing. But after a while, I finally got kind of hungry, and so I decided I would go back inside. Well, at this point, things got strange. When I turned to go back inside, my apartment was gone. I swear there was nothing there. Everything else was exactly the same except my apartment. It just wasn't there. I began to look around because this courtyard was enclosed on all sides with apartments similar to mine, but I still couldn't find my own place of residence. Well, I began to panic. I was trying to tell myself maybe I was just confused. Maybe I'd somehow become disoriented. But following numerous walks around the entire courtyard, my apartment was sure enough nowhere to be found. And so I started screaming and crying. I called my mother, and I was basically scared out of my mind. I screamed for my mom for what felt like forever until suddenly I did hear her voice calling me, asking me what was wrong. And then it was over. I never really said anything about this to anyone. Now, in truth, this incident has always been in the back of my mind, and I've analyzed it in every way that I can think of in the years since it happened. All I have managed to come up with is that maybe I had been disoriented in some way, or something else pretty strange was going on. And then much later on, when I was a teenager, I was reading one of John Keel's books, and he mentioned people experiencing time warps, where they're either surrounded by a mist or maybe a fog and end up somewhere else or in a different time. Or maybe they become dizzy. They sit down and the same sort of thing happens that I experienced. I don't recall seeing any mist, and I certainly don't remember feeling dizzy. For me, it was all very abrupt. Have you ever heard of something like this happening to anyone else? Like I said before, I've really never told anyone of this occurrence, but it has haunted me my entire life. I had never seen a UFO or a ghost or anything else like that until fairly recently in my life, but this particular experience, this one that I write to you about tonight, this is the one I credit with being the sole reason I started reading about the paranormal in the first place. Any conjecture would be much appreciated at your leisure. Thank you, Damien. Well, Damien, that's a strange story, and I'll tell you this. It is very reminiscent of the sorts of things that not only John Keel often wrote about, but also that we heard about in years past in terms of what are called time slips. People will be walking down a street, maybe, you know, headed to their home, and all of a sudden something strange happens. You know, something's not quite right. They feel a bit disoriented. And sure enough, before they know it, they're surrounded by, well, surroundings that they are unfamiliar with. This happens to Chris every night on his way home. It does. And yet we don't understand what causes this strange experience. What is it that causes the time slip? Is it relative to that individual? Is there something about that person's perception that seems to alter the physicality of space around them? Or is it something else? Is space actually altering? Are they actually, well, passing through a parallel dimension or something along those lines and entering another state of being, which we don't presently have any kind of an explanation for how or what could constitute that sort of entry into such a state? It's a very, very, very strange concept indeed. Damien, that's the best we could offer at the moment. If the listeners out there have ever experienced anything along those lines themselves, of course, we invite you to touch base with us here on the Graylian Report. Send along your stories, info@graylianreport.com. You can also send along commentary. You know, you don't have to just be sharing, as Jim Harold, our guest tonight, would be talking about them campfire stories. If you have other observations, you can send those along just as well. We have one here from William, who wrote, "Micah, I saw an article about the Hestelin lights recently, a favorite since they actually did real research pertaining to these." Now, the Hestelin lights, you know, you've probably heard us on this program talk about the Brown Mountain lights quite often. The Hestelin lights in Norway are a very similar form of phenomenon, some sort of strange, what many call an earthlight phenomenon. Well, he said, "It sounds like a good conference," and he sends a link to this. We'll try and include that in the show notes for this week. But he says, "But the above article said some rather odd things. For instance, there is no reason whatsoever, according to the researchers in this article that William sends along, to suppose that the phenomena is under any kind of intelligent control. They also state that, quote, nothing has been reported suggesting these orbs have intelligence or that they are being guided by any kind of intelligence." Again, we're talking about a strange variety of earthlight phenomenon that occurs in Hestelin, Norway. Well, William says, "I recalled one of the scientists who was a co-author of a conference paper saying on his webpage, quote, we used a laser and pointed it toward a flashing light in two different cases for a total of 9 times. But get this, 8 of those times there was a reaction when we shone a laser on one of these strange orbs of light that appeared over the mountainside. Again, this was at Hesteland, Norway. In the first case, there was a regular flashing light slowly moving toward the north. This occurred on Sunday, the 12th of February at 7:35 p.m. The flashing had been regular all the time we had seen the light. The light moved slowly. From this time, the first time we saw this light, it was in the south until it disappeared again in the north. It took about 15 minutes total. When this light was in the northern part of Finnsgod, which is a rough, probably bastardization of a Finnish term there, we pointed the laser toward it for the first time. At once, this object changed its flashing sequence from a regular flashing light. It became a regular double flashing light. To help you visualize this, imagine a white light that was moving along, and it would flash every couple of seconds, flash, flash, every couple of seconds, flash, like that. When they shone a laser on this light, the light began to go flash, 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 flash. It changed the pattern in which it would behave. Well, after about 10 seconds, we put the laser down, and once again, this object became a regular single flashing light again. After about 10 seconds, we repeated this again. It was repeated a total of 4 times before this object went completely out of sight. And every time, we got this same double flashing when a laser was directed at this object. And in the second case, the same type of light came from the north and moved toward the south. It was the same day, Sunday, 12th of February, 8:41 p.m. was the time. When the light was in the west, we pointed the laser toward it. The same thing happened now. It was changed to a double flashing light. Flash, 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 flash. And always when that laser was pointed directly at it. Now, this time we did this 5 times. Only the last of these times did we not get any kind of double flashing. But 4 of those 5 times we certainly did. The test was done like this. Kurt Persson used binoculars looking at the light, and he would tell us what he was seeing at all times. Erling Strand, another of our associates, used the laser, which was directed at the object, and he said he could not see where he was pointing, or rather, he could not see where the laser had been pointed. When I raised the laser pointing at the light, he said, flash, flash. In other words, what they're articulating here is the man with the binoculars could not see where he could see the way that this object was moving. Okay. The gentleman pointing the laser could not see what the reaction on the object was, but he could see that he was pointing a laser at the object. So the man with the binoculars was able to see both what the object was doing, as well as the laser hitting at the other man who was directing the laser, could not see the flash apparently as vividly, but he was able to direct the laser at this thing. And then there was another person, okay, on board who was a witness to what we were doing. He also observed this, and he said that there were other persons out at the moment, but they were all concentrating on other various scientific endeavors there while studying this. And then there's a final quote about all this. They said, maybe the strangest thing that had been happening with those tests with the laser was that before the fieldwork, people told us the light disappeared when a strong spotlight was directed at it. We wanted to test that as well. Instead of a spotlight, we used what's called a Heaney laser. A regular flashing light was traveling toward the north. So we took this laser and directed the beam onto the light. It became a double flashing light, as we had observed many times before. But once we moved the beam away, the light went back to a regular flashing light again. We directed the beam onto it again, and it started the double flashing at once. We did this up and down with the laser beam 4 times while this light was moving toward the north. Every time, it doubled its frequency of flashing. The second test was carried out 1 hour later when a similar light was traveling toward the south. The same thing happened, and now we moved the laser beam up onto the light and down away from the light a total of 5 times. 4 of those 5 times, that frequency doubled. But 1 week after our test with the laser, get this, they said a red light began to move around their feet. That's right, the observers there on the ground who had been conducting these tests, they said, we saw what looked like a red laser light moving around our feet on the ground. It looked just as if a similar laser to ours had been used. It lasted only a couple of seconds and not long enough to find out where it came from. The only place it could possibly have come from, as far as we could tell, was the sky. Had the light that they'd been observing, or rather the various kinds of lights, had this mimicked the laser that they'd been shining at it and now directed one at the ground toward them? Very strange. William writes also that they mention how hardware failed or was not ready when the phenomena appeared and disappeared, And then, of course, when that hardware was ready, some of these objects had already disappeared. Perhaps this implies some sort of intelligence or shyness. So at least one of the researchers in this experience had had experiences that seemed to indicate intelligent behavior demonstrated by these lights that appear at Hestalen. I was surprised, William says, that these events were not mentioned. It's kind of like cherry-picking data. Perhaps they don't want to lose credibility. That always happens if one mentions any kind of intelligence that's associated with UFOs. But what are we to make of that? It's one thing to say that maybe the pattern of the lights themselves change every time that there is a laser shown at them. That's easy enough to understand. But what happens? What are we to make of this when apparently these lights... And again, this is maybe only in one instance, so repeatability, I think, is a factor that has to be taken into consideration in terms of the science of the circumstances. But they claim that some sort of a red laser light was shown at their feet as if coming from somewhere above them, maybe from one of the lights. Had these objects, were they intelligent, and had they managed to replicate this process that was being performed on them and shine something laser-esque back at the researchers who had been studying them? Strange indeed, and strange is our middle name here at the Graylian Report. We'll be back right after this.
Hi, this is Micah Hanks of the Graylian Report. Have you heard about the Paradigm Symposium 2012 yet? Well, it's going to be a huge event we're putting on along with Intrepid Magazine up in Minneapolis, Minnesota this October 18th through 21st. But rather than just having me tell you about it, here's George Norrie from Coast to Coast AM. George?
Thanks, Micah. This is George Norrie of Coast to Coast AM inviting you to attend the Paradigm Symposium 2012. If you love UFOs and aliens, lost civilizations, and mysteries of the past, well, this is the event for you. And all you have to do to learn more is visit ParadigmSymposium.com.
The Paradigm Symposium 2012, reviewing our past and changing our future. Check us out online, ParadigmSymposium.com. That website again, ParadigmSymposium.com.
Back to the Graylian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, joined in studio as always by Chris Hayes and Matthew Oakley. It's always our honor, privilege, and pleasure to broadcast to you every week. And, of course, discuss the strange and unusual on, of course, what is no doubt your favorite hub for such studies. That's right. We're always involved in these sorts of things. We've got some new literature here at the Graylian Report, the world's most mysterious places, by our good friend, field correspondent, and, of course, fellow author, Mr. Nick Redfern. He'll be joining us on the program soon to promote this book. And those of you who are attending that little shindig that we're going to be holding up in the real Twin Cities that I mentioned earlier, the Paradigm Symposium, that's right. Nick Redfern, of course, is going to be one of our key speakers at the Paradigm Symposium this year, along with Eric Von Daniken, George Norrie, Philip Coppens, Giorgio Tsoukalos, and so many others. You certainly don't want to miss that. ParadigmSymposium.com. Check it out. It's not too late to get tickets, and especially those of you in the Minneapolis area. You want to check into that. We're also going to be joined soon by Nancy Duterte, who is author of the book Psychic Intuition, Everything You Ever Wanted to Ask But Were Afraid to Know. Nancy has been corresponding with us, and we're very delighted to have her booked and ready to join us on the Graylian Report. Of course, that'll be in a few weeks. But nonetheless, something for our listeners to look forward to. And something I always look forward to on this program is the reports of the strange and the unusual that occur right here in the region from which we broadcast, Matt. this one comes along via Vance Pollock, one of our historical field correspondents. He said, Micah, I thought you would enjoy this article from the 19th of May, 1908, that appeared in the Asheville Citizen. Yes, we broadcast from Asheville, North Carolina. He said, there are follow-up reports over the next few days in subsequent issues which seem to indicate that this was maybe a panther. But the opening line is a little different because it suggests, as Matt Oakley pointed out earlier, what they described as being a donkey devil. Beware the donkey devil of Western North Carolina. Oh, yeah.
It just doesn't get better than that, I don't think.
It's hard to top a donkey devil. Vance asks, was this an early sighting of the Renabra... I don't know if I could even pronounce this word. Renabra Donkeytron. Where do you come up with this stuff, Vance? The Renabra Donkeytron. The headline reads, Mysterious Beast Kills Young Calf. People at Kenilworth terrified by strange screams in the night. I'll tell you, the story leads off with this mention of strange screams. Indeed, that does sound much like a panther. An animal that cries like a child, but with tracks like a beast. This creature was sought through Western North Carolina. And the first line of the actual article reads, has the donkey devil come back to Asheville? The donkey devil. Well, either it or some equally fearsome creature had apparently appeared around the Kenilworth Inn and was frightening people greatly. On its first appearance, Saturday of the week in question, this animal terrified a lady and her children who have a cottage on the path by its wild screams, the screams of this alleged donkey devil. Two bulldogs of approved courage, they say, went forth to meet it, but when they saw it, they turned tail and ran, and it must have indeed been a queer beast which caused them to act in such a way. Its cry was something like that of a child. Wherefore, people suppose it is, quote, a panther or wildcat, but on Sunday, a lady and gentleman who examined the tracks said that they were long and showed signs of claws that were more like a bear's tracks. Interesting. And so, although the general idea was that this object, this creature, was some sort of a panther, they referred to it in this article as a donkey devil. Why a donkey devil? Some think the animal is a panther, others that it is a bear, and still others that it is a tiger escaped from a circus. A tiger escaped from a circus in Tennessee some weeks ago, and it is thought that this may be the same beast that visited Asheville, North Carolina in 1908. And nonetheless, even though none of those animals resemble donkeys or devils for that matter, this thing is referred to as a donkey devil.
That's exactly what I was thinking, like a tiger and a, you know, all of these, it's like, wow, absolutely nothing like a donkey.
Yes, a strange pig-like beast has been seen in the mountains of Western North Carolina. We've dubbed it the Dragon Scorpion.
Yeah, like, it's a bear.
It's a bear, but it looked like a bear. It looked like a pig covered in hair with claws and lasers shooting out of its eyes.
Wait, are you talking about Man Bear Pig?
Oh, yeah. No, we're talking about the Renabra Donkatron. Oh, goodness, yes. This is how folklore is created. I think we've just seen the genesis of a folktale here, folks. You know, I'd mentioned earlier in the program that we had some updates about this alleged object that had been found in the Baltic Sea. You know, news out of Sweden has apparently shown that some are taking a look at what this object is that OceanX divers are calling an anomaly at the bottom of the Baltic Sea, according to some descriptions by divers. Now, this thing, they've released drawings online, okay, that purport to show fairly accurately what this thing that they've gone down there and looked at seems to resemble. What we know is that the object is large, it is a circular formation, and it has, get this, what look like stairs leading up one side. So it does appear to be some sort of a construction. But it's uncertain at present whether this object is connected to the base of the ocean or if it is indeed something separate. According to OceanX explorers, the circle, as they're calling it, is 80 meters deep. The object is above or rather the object as above, is circular and has a diameter of 60 meters. It looks like a staircase to the left based on divers' videos and other observations that have been seen at this point. Very little, of course, has been released thus far. Our studies show that the object is separated from the bottom. Okay, so they say that this thing is actually not a part of the ocean floor itself. It is located on a ridge or a hill with steep slopes on the sides, and during the last expedition it was confirmed that there is indeed a wedge-formed gap between the upper part, the circle, and the lower part, the foundation, or what they call the pillar. However, if the two parts are completely separated, or rather if the upper part and the lower part are the same object, it has not yet been clarified. So, see, it seems a little inconsistent. They seem somewhat back and forth on that. I'll tell you, from what little I have seen, I do get the impression that this must be some sort of a structure. There's a possibility that this is a natural formation that resembles some sort of a physical structure, but from what they're describing, they say that this thing, the shape and, of course, the staircase and the other identifying marks on this object, they seem to dispel the notion that this was something that just looked a lot like a, well, what many are calling a UFO. Chris, do you think that there's a UFO sitting down there on the bottom of the Baltic Sea?
Well, absolutely. It's the Millennium Falcon. That's what it looks like.
You know, a lot of people are saying it does look like the Millennium Falcon. They've said that since early on.
Or it could be a wagon wheel or the roof of a structure that fell into the Baltic Sea.
Right.
Or any number of things that are round.
Who knows what that thing is? But there's something down there. There's something down there. You know, we've talked often about how when people listen to this program, if you would like to help support the Graylian Report and our fantastic endeavors that we bring to you for free on a weekly basis from live hundreds of miles beneath the Earth's surface here in the Mohorovic discontinuity, you know, if you go to www.graylianreport.com, you'll see all kinds of wonderful articles and other news updates. Matt Oakley's got a new piece over there at the Graylian Report, and of course I've got one about animal communication, and of course you've got links to all the existing podcasts which are archived on our servers. But I'll tell you this, you can also click the PayPal button there on the website. That will send a donation of your choice and denomination, of course, or the amount, rather. You have, you know, we have to take USD, but you can certainly pick the amount and send that along to us. If you'd like to help us out, that's how you do it. Just go to graylianreport.com, graylianreport.com. If you haven't got money to give, that's okay. We're not asking for money, but we always love it when people interact with the program, and you're welcome also maybe just to send us an email. We always appreciate that as well, and we all, of course, always draw from stories that our listeners like to send along. There are always fascinating stories. You know, Jim Harold, who's going to be joining us during the second hour of tonight's program, Jim really kind of builds his format around going out and finding true stories of strange occurrences that people have had. I mean, who doesn't enjoy a good story? That's why he called his book The Campfire, Jim Harold's The Campfire. And so when I asked Jim, what do you want to talk about on the program tonight, Jim? You know, of course, he's a radio host like us, but he's also one of the best-known podcasters, and he's a well-known author and all this other stuff. And so I said, Jim, what do you want to talk about? And Jim said, you know, I'd like to kick it off with a couple of campfire stories tonight. So we're going to hear a couple of really good stories from Jim Harold during the next hour. You know, we spend a lot of time focusing on more, heavy material on this program, you know, the reality of UFOs, space-time anomalies, and we do it in a very lighthearted way, but nonetheless, it's a very demanding sort of content that we provide sort of lighthearted commentary on this program. Tonight, we're going to rest our brains a little bit, Matt and Chris and I, and we're going to allow Jim Harold to share some of his campfire stories with us, as he calls them, here on the Graylian Report. That's something to look forward to during the next hour. But talking about raising money, okay, we've told you how you could help the Graylian Report, and you can always send along donations, but did you know that there's one guy who, well, raised an unprecedented amount of money in the last week for a very good cause? Have you heard about this? The Nikola Tesla Museum? Anybody heard this? Get this. io9.com reported that Matthew Inman, creator of a new website called The Oatmeal, it's a website that features webcomics and other humorous entertainment, well, it recently launched what Inman describes as, quote, a campaign to try and raise enough money to buy Nikola Tesla's old laboratory. The Wardenclyffe Tower, which is, I understand, was located in Colorado Springs. Well, the land, laboratory, and foundation beneath what was once Nikola Tesla's Wardenclyffe Tower, Inman hopes, would be the future site of a museum in Tesla's honor. Now, recently at The Oatmeal, Mr. Inman had featured a funny web comic that was talking about why Nikola Tesla basically rocks, and also why he was also better than Thomas Edison. That's a view I also hold here on the Grayling Report. I know my producer and co-host, Mr. Chris Hayes, does as well. Well, last week, Inman said he hoped to be able to somehow manage to raise $850,000. That would be matched dollar for dollar, of course, by a grant from New York State over a 45-day period with hopes of securing the $1.6 million property. Well, things apparently went better than expected. Of course, in a matter of days, the Oatmeal's fundraising campaign, as has been reported, vastly exceeded its initial goals in a statement that appeared at the Oatmeal website. In 9 days, we managed to raise over $1 million to go toward buying back Tesla's old laboratory and with the $850,000 matching grant from New York State, which puts us at $1.85 million. They needed to raise about $1.6 total.
Three of those $1.85 million are mine.
Ah, yes, indeed. We have a philanthropist right here in our midst. Now, according to Inman, at its peak, the campaign was raising $27,000 per hour. He said crashing Indiegogo, the crowdfunding platform used to raise the money, and probably setting some kind of land speed record in awesomeness. Matthew Inman of the Oatmeal, that certainly is our definition of awesomeness here at the Grayling Report. Kudos on that, my friend. And who knows, maybe at some point the Grayling Report will do so well as to raise that kind of money. What we would do with that kind of money, talk about philanthropists. I think that there would be a lot of charity organizations reached out to. The Grayling Report would probably host some sort of an event in many major American cities. And then, of course, we would probably try and put together some sort of a very special something that we could put out to our listeners for free in gratitude. Who knows? Who knows? But it just goes to show that when you reach out to people and you ask for help, if you've got a good cause in mind, well, the help's out there. And really what it comes down to is just going after it and asking about, well, what you need. Matthew Inman, of course, he needed money, as most of us do, but he hoped to do something good with it. And who better to remember than Nikola Tesla, the father of, well, maybe the master of lightning, and arguably the father of not only alternating current, but a lot of the electrical systems and things that we know here in the United States and surrounding world today. When we come back, we're going to talk about a tragic instance in the crypto community. Yes, unfortunately, it involves a Bigfoot hoax. We'll get to that here in a moment on the Grayling Report.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by. Never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. Wounded Warrior Project was created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war, whether those scars are physical or mental. Wounded Warrior Project. We never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Learn more about what we do at WoundedWarriorProject.org.
Casting like a trifecta of blazing Renobra donkey trons from the heart of Moho. That's right, we are the Graylians. This is your weekly Graylian Report, and I am the mouth of the South, Micah Hanks, joined in studio by Matt Oakley and, of course, the producer with the... What rhymes with producer, Chris?
I don't know. That's one of those that, like, orange and calcium. What yeah. Rhymes with those?
Exactly. Orange... Okay, let me get back to you on both of those.
Yeah, we're all, like, sitting here looking up at the ceiling, like, calcium.
Yeah, the water dripping down from those stalactites over there. Let's see here. Calcium.
Don't lose her?
Right?
But it's not a word.
Close enough. Oh, producer. Oh, I was going to say, don't lose her doesn't rhyme with calcium.
No.
No, it doesn't.
You know, in my opinion, there's probably nothing more tragic than when a hoax runs afoul. And I really don't intend, I want to go ahead and just put out a disclaimer. I don't make any attempt here to make fun of a tragedy or poke fun at it or make light of a tragedy, because what we're about to relate here during this final segment of Hour 1 on this week's edition of the Graylian Report, this is indeed a tragedy, but it could have been avoided had the individual who unfortunately became a victim, if this individual had simply, utilized a little more caution and discretion in his judgment prior to doing what he did. Randy Lee Tenley, age 44, of Kalispell, Montana, had reportedly been wearing a ghillie suit. He was dressed as a Bigfoot and had been trying to create a Bigfoot sighting on U.S. Highway 93. Cryptomundo.com reports that, yes, he was attempting to pull off a hoax. Instead, however, he ended up dead, struck by two automobiles on Sunday evening, August 26, 2012. Tenley was first struck by a vehicle driven by a 15-year-old Summers girl in the southbound right lane. She could not get out of the way fast enough to avoid hitting Tenley, who had apparently been running across the road in this ghillie suit. If you're not familiar with a ghillie suit, these are military-style suits, okay? Camouflaged in such a way that they will allow one to blend in with undergrowth and things like that. And so it's a very shaggy-looking kind of dark camouflage. Yeah, from a distance, this would certainly resemble a Bigfoot. Well, Tenley had been wearing one of these and had apparently been trying to run across U.S. Highway 93 when he was struck by a 15-year-old driver in the right southbound lane. Well, then Tenley, after being struck by the first driver, was struck again by another vehicle, this one driven by 17-year-old Summers girl, who hit his body, which had apparently been lying in the road after the first impact.
I bet they were texting.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's tragic on many counts. But, you know, this did result in the death of this individual who had been very foolishly trying to hoax a Bigfoot sighting in Montana.
And I do want to point out that it was, guess what, all for naught. Because not one call was made saying anybody hit Bigfoot on the highway.
Well, exactly, because, yeah, it was pretty obvious that after the coroners issued their report, well, it was a man in a ghillie suit.
He gave his life for nothing, though.
In fact, Jim Schneider, who was a Montana Highway Patrol trooper, had told the media the mechanics of the crash, everything of that nature, you know, that stuff doesn't change. It's still a crash involving vehicles and a pedestrian, so we're still doing the same sort of investigation, but once we started speaking to parties, then someone involved in it, trying to ascertain exactly what brought that gentleman out into the middle of Highway 93 and no less clad in this strange kind of camouflage, well, he said, I would not guess that would motivate anybody to be out on Highway 93. So Schneider says that they are awaiting toxicology results. They hope to determine if alcohol may have been a factor in Tenley's strange behavior. Schneider says friends of the victim said Tenley was indeed wearing a military-style camouflage ghillie suit in hopes of creating a Bigfoot hoax. Boy, it really was not worth it, was it?
The thing is I have to wonder, because you said alcohol hadn't been ruled out at this time, and that was actually my first question I posed to myself when I read the story, because, again, I'm not trying to make light of this, but don't you think it would be just as effective to do it maybe, well, even more so, actually, in perhaps a wooded area where you could disappear quickly or something like that, you know, instead of walking out into the middle of the highway.
But you never know if you're in the woods whether or not someone's going to see you. If you're crossing a busy highway, someone is going to see you. Plus, there's always those, much like with the Mothman, always those sightings of, I was driving down the road and I saw this thing just come out of the woods. And there it was.
Exactly. Come out of the woods. Don't
but
run
into the
across
road.
The highway. No.
I'm sure there's highways going through the woods.
Are these just chance encounters with these sorts of strange creatures, though, if these things actually exist? You know, I kind of ride the fence on that one. Chris, you know, we were talking about Mothman earlier. I'm not so sure that I believe that what we know as the quote-unquote Mothman ever actually existed. Now, I'll tell you this, though. I know that something was going on in Point Pleasant, but even John Keel, author of the book The Mothman Prophecies, later came out and said, you know, it seems that there were reports of something more akin to a Bigfoot being seen, in addition to some reports of some very large birds. Not to assert foul play here, but that there were indeed a multitude of things, and it seems that the press at the time was sort of kind of lumping all this together into this one singular, winged, but very large, and at times humanoid beast known as the Mothman, right? But there is a certain, maybe even a peculiar persistence in these reports where people are driving along down a highway and they see something strange. You know, at her website, Linda Godfrey, okay, who authored the book The Beast of Bray Road, talking about a real American, well, what they call a werewolf, she included this encounter from 1983 on her website recently. She said that the person wrote in and said, "Me and three other friends, guess what? We were driving around the Hubertus Holy Hill area. I was 18 at the time, and the time was late in the evening, around 11:30 p.m. or so, and as I drove through the winding wooded road up ahead in my headlight beam, we saw a wolf walk across the road, but not on four legs. This wolf, they said, walked on two legs. After it cleared the road, it got down on all fours and then ran off into the woods, briefly looking back at us. We never reported this because who would believe four teenagers joyriding at night? But I did tell my family and a few close friends. I'm still in contact with two of the people who saw this with me, and now at age 47, I thought I would share my story, since you've been recording these sorts of sightings. Linda Godfrey, of course, is well known for reporting these instances of encounters with an alleged, well, what looks like a wolf that walks on two legs, okay, up in the northern parts of the United States. This one, I believe, comes from Minnesota. The main thing that was ingrained in our mind was that this thing walked on two legs as it crossed the road. I remember saying, wolves don't do that, do they? The girls in the car with us were so scared, and they told me to start driving to get out of the way, get just away from this thing. It was summertime, or else we wouldn't have even been out there that late, but the trees did have heavy foliage. And they include an illustration of this creature, and indeed it looks very much like a wolf, but again, this thing was walking upright. So we have stories of Bigfoot, prolific enough that certain people think it would be funny to get out there and hoax this sort of thing. You know, these Minnesota Dogman encounters have been hoaxed, at least in one instance. I think there was a man in what, well, probably was also a ghillie suit, who did a very convincing piece of footage that was featured not only on the program Monster Quest, but I think it was even featured on Sean Hannity's television program on Fox News. Of all things, it was known as the Gable film. You remember this one, Matt?
Yeah, because I remember finding it with you years ago.
Yeah.
And just watching it on repeat, absolutely blown away by what we were looking
because
at.
Because the footage does seem to show what looks kind of like a dogish kind of bear thing. It's on four legs, and it starts really, I mean, making, its way toward the camera very quickly. It's a frightening piece of footage, I'll have to say. It's a very frightening piece of footage. But then they showed on the program Monster Quest how an individual had come forward and had alleged that he had indeed been behind the hoaxing of this footage and even, of course, was willing to get in front of the cameras there, the Monster Quest film crew and whatnot, and actually act this out and replicate what we saw in the alleged Gable film. So, indeed, what seems to be pretty convincing evidence at times can be the simple work of a hoaxer. And who knows, maybe if he hadn't been struck by two vehicles, this gentleman there, Randy Lee Tenley, age 44, of Kalispell, Montana, maybe he would have been the next in line to have really, you know, fooled somebody.
I don't know. I just, and you know, you can't positively say unless you were in that situation. But I honestly have to say that I think if that was me and I saw a guy in a ghillie suit running across the freeway, I'd be like, what the hell is that guy doing? Like, what's wrong with him?
Maybe we're more, we're more discerning, you know, because of the nature of what we do, Matt, you know. We get out there, we talk about this sort of thing. We've always got a watchful eye and a skeptical eye. You know, I think here at the Grayling Report, Chris especially among the three of us, but all of us, we tend to gravitate more toward a skeptical mode of thinking when it comes to our study of this sort of phenomena. In fact, you know, Scotty Roberts and I are working on a brand new book together, and this book is actually going to detail some of our conundrums with the dichotomy that exists between the quote-unquote believer camp and then the people who are really not what I would call true skeptics, but instead what I would call pseudo-skeptics, you know, people who go in with a preconception and they really have no hope for doing anything but justifying their preconceptions. And thereby going about the serious classification of everything strange and unusual as bunk. And they go about, well, debunking everything that they can with or without evidence to do so. So you've got these two extremes, people who believe blindly without asking questions, and then those who want to debunk preconceived in their notion that everything is indeed explainable according to the known laws of physics and, of course, the known laws of science. I don't think that's always the case, and so I think the true skeptic puts themselves in the middle, and that's certainly what we are here on this program. We're skeptical, but nonetheless, I think that if I saw a person running across the street in what looked like a ghillie suit, well, yeah, I would hesitate to say, yes, I've seen a Sasquatch.
Yeah, I want to say, though, the thing is I think regardless of what you do or how much time you spend researching the paranormal like we do, people aren't inundated with Bigfoot every day, so I really doubt that the majority of people, like, their first thing would be like, Bigfoot, you know?
Well, exactly. But some would, probably.
Some, but not as many as I would think you should hope to
reach. It would take something extraordinary for me to really say, wow, now I'm really wondering. But maybe our guest in the next hour, Mr. Jim Harrell, with his campfire stories, will bring something truly extraordinary to the table. It is the Graylian Report, and we'll be back right after this.
Have you ever looked up at the stars at night and wondered, are we really alone? Could there be other life out there? And could it have influenced life here on Earth? This is George Norrie of Coast to Coast AM, and I'm excited to tell you about the Paradigm Symposium 2012. It's an event being held this October 18th through the 21st in Minneapolis, Minnesota. If you've ever wondered about the mysteries of our universe and of our ancient past, this is the event for you. And it's not just a conference. The Paradigm Symposium will feature unique presentations, a banquet dinner, and guest lectures by me and names like Eric Von Daniken, author of Chariots of the Gods, as well as Giorgio Tsoukalos, Philip Coppens, and many others. Tickets are selling fast, so reserve yours today. And all you have to do is visit ParadigmSymposium.com. That's ParadigmSymposium.com. Reviewing our past, changing our future. The Paradigm Symposium 2012, brought to you by Intrepid Magazine and The Graylian Report.
Theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks, and you're listening live to the Graylian Report. Or, of course, you may have also downloaded the subsequent podcast, which we issue for free each week from our fantastic little dark corner of the web, graylianreport.com, where you can learn more about the weird news, exopolitics, and news from beyond the fringe that we feature each week here on the program. I'm joined, as always, in studio by producer Chris Hayes and engineer Matt Oakley. And while you're over there checking out the website, you do want to also take a look at our links to Paradigm Symposium and none other than Intrepid Magazine, our partners in putting on the symposium this year. Intrepid Magazine, of course, features the latest in a variety of things, news, politics, the unexplained, UFOs. Matt Oakley in the upcoming issue of Intrepid Magazine also has a feature article about the Hell's Angels, which is very interesting. I mean, it's a really a wide variety of different sorts of things that you're going to be finding in Intrepid Magazine. I'm talking about Admiral Richard Byrd and his expeditions to the Antarctic regions and, of course, his alleged encounters with, well, humans from beneath the Earth. What does that sound like to you? One of our listeners wrote just this week, in fact, and said, "Don't mind the haters. We love all the Hadle talk on the program." Indeed, we enjoy talking about Hadles on this program, too. We enjoy any kind of talk of that sort, I believe. But aside from all Hadle talk, you know, we also enjoy just a good yarn from time to time here on the program as well. It doesn't have to necessarily have to do with Hadles for it to be, well, something that's going to pick our interest on this program. And therefore, it is with great pleasure that I welcome to the program our guest tonight. He is the host of the Paranormal Podcast, and of course, he's also an author himself, Jim Harold's Campfire, True Ghost Stories, released by New Page Books. If you are looking for something good this Halloween, I'll tell you, Halloween's going to be right upon us here before long. This is the kind of book that you're going to want to find. And joining us tonight is Jim Harold, who will share a few of his campfire stories with us live on the program. Jim, welcome to the Graylean Report.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on the show, Micah. It is an absolute pleasure, and I'm looking forward to some campfire stories.
Yes, well, we are too, Jim. You know, last time you and I spoke, I believe I was on your show. And
yes.
So I thought, you know, this guy, he's so full of good stories. You know, it's a shame, even though he's a fantastic, maybe the best host that there is out there, it's a shame that he doesn't get to come on these programs as a guest as often as he's doing shows himself. You are a frequent guest, but we wanted to make sure that we extended that invitation and had you on this program as well. So, Jim, what's happening?
Well, we got a lot of exciting stuff going over at jimharold.com. Of course, I have the Paranormal Podcast, as you mentioned, and we also have my podcast, Jim Harold's Campfire, on which the book was based, and we're just pushing through and some exciting things on the horizon. And the most exciting thing on the horizon, not too long, Mike, until Halloween time.
Oh, yes. You know, that's, if you're anything like me, you know, that's our favorite time of the year. We darklings, we love that sort of stuff. And, of course, the three of us here on this program, we broadcast from a cave underground. So we get a lot of darkness. You know, sunlight is not our friend. And those who enjoy this program, I'm sure they're kind of like us. So these stories, you know, you use this almost archetypal terminology for the stories that you share. The campfire. There is something to me that's very archetypal about, you know, people gathering around the campfire and sharing these stories. It's the perfect environment for sharing stories of the strange and unusual. So, as I understand, we're going to kick this off tonight with a couple of stories from the campfire, so to speak, that you're going to deliver to our audience.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Just give people a little bit of background. For the last few years, I've been doing a podcast called Jim Harold's Campfire. And basically what it is are real people calling up and telling their stories. And we have people from all over the world that do that. And it's funny because I kind of started as a sideline. And even though maybe it's not as popular as my paranormal podcast show, I think that the listenership is much more intense because people love to hear other people tell stories and they feel that they're not alone. It's almost like a paranormal support group, I guess, to know that there's other people out there that have weird things happening. The first story I'd like to tell is by a lady's name is T.I., and she's from Michigan, I believe. This is a story that happened to her up in Wisconsin. I absolutely love this story. T.I. and her friend were out checking out a band at a club. And it was up in northern Wisconsin, kind of a rural area. And it was, I guess, closing time. And they were probably, I think, about an hour from the area where they lived. So they were driving back. And anybody, Micah, I'm sure you have, if you've ever driven through a rural area, night is different than it is in the city.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Pitch black. It's absolutely dark and haunting. And basically, what happened was is that T.I. admitted she had the call of nature, but it was past 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, nothing's open. And she said, well, I'll bear it out and we'll just go on home. So anyway, they come upon this bar. And even though it's after 2 o'clock in the morning, it's like this roadhouse, this old roadhouse. And there's these neon signs and it's obviously open. So she says, well, if we can stop here, that'll be great. Her male friend pulled in. There were cars in the parking lot there. And they went in, and it was kind of surreal, she said. You know, there was like this guy, this young strapping guy behind the bar. There were various people there. They smiled, but they didn't say a lot. So she went in, answered the call. They got a beer. And her friend said he was very interested in this place because there was a strange mural on the wall. Very ornate. And they started looking at it and noticing it. And some more weird things started to happen. For example, there was this toothless man that walked up to my listener and asked her to dance. He had put an old song on the old-time jukebox that was there with the old 45s. It was Chubby Checker's Let's Twist Again. Oh. And he said, do you want to dance? And she had a cane, and she said, no, I can't dance. So that kind of got her out of that. But that point will come back a little bit later. So the people almost didn't interact. They smiled. This guy interacted. They looked at this mural. They had a beer or two, and they started to look at it, and they noticed that the figures on the mural were approximations of the people in the bar. Now, the theme of the mural was kind of an Old West scene. Uh-huh. But there were some people playing cards, and there were some people playing cards, two or three guys, same amount of guys playing cards on the mural. There's somebody playing pool, I think. Same thing. And then they noticed that there were two figures walking in the door, a man and a woman. And they looked at it a little more closely, and these figures weren't as well-defined. And they looked very closely and realized that the man looked, T.I. realized it looked very much like her male friend, and the woman who had a skirt, same length that she had on, and a cane.
Huh.
Well, needless to say, they realized that that looked very much like them in the doorway. Yeah, exactly, exactly. So anyway, they said, let's get the heck out of here. So anyway, they get out of there, go out of the door. As soon as they close the door, everything goes dead silent.
Huh.
All the lights go off like it was never opened. Even the neon lights and everything go dead silent. Not only that, there's only one car in the parking lot. Theirs. So anyway, it gets even better. So what happens next is, you know, they go home and they're talking with some friends and family, and they go, they say, we're going to go back. So my listener goes back with a family member, and they go in the daytime. She said, I'm not going late at night again. And they walk in, and there's a young lady who's the bartender. And she says, I was just in here the other night. Where's the young guy who was the bartender? And she's like, there's only two bartenders here, and one of them's my dad.
Oh. Huh.
And then they look over. There is a jukebox. It's a jukebox with CDs, thank you very much. The mural was still there, but I don't believe she saw any sign of herself or her friend. So I kind of wonder, that's a very kind of Twilight Zone-y story. Now, I wonder exactly what they encountered. Maybe it was a little bit of an alternate universe.
It's funny because earlier in the program tonight, we actually, Jim had talked about a story that someone had sent in where they had said that they, and this guy, he was very young at the time that this story was told, but he'd said that essentially what had happened to him was that his apartment had disappeared. He had been playing in this little playground area in the middle of these, in this kind of courtyard between all these apartments, and he sees right. that this is, you know, his home has disappeared. All the other apartments are there, but something's not quite right. And it's funny because you hear these stories where people describe these things as anything from being a time slip to being a,
yes,
who knows what's going on, you know? And so this person walks into this bar, and it's like they entered, what is it, an alternate dimension? Are they looking into a mirror? are they seeing an alternate dimension or something
and,
like
that? And I got to tell you, this is a theme through my show, and I'm sure you see it with your people. A lot of these people, you know, there are people who will tell you 27 different ghost stories that happen to them. And I do believe that some people are more sensitive, so I don't want to discount this. But a lot of sure. times you'll get somebody with the most incredible story, and they'll say, that's the only thing that's ever happened to me. And they're not in it for the fame. They're not in it for money or anything like that, because, quite frankly, coming on my show and telling a story, it's not gonna make anybody any money.
Right.
But the thing is that's why I love talking to real people about their real stories. And you can kind of, I mean, I'm sure you've developed this radar over time, Micah and the team there. When you listen to someone, if they're being straight with you and they believe what they saw. And I mean, You know, it's one thing maybe to see a light in the sky and think, oh, that could have been a plane or it could have been something else. But a story like that, what other explanation except for the supernatural or some, as you said, you know, some type of alternate science that we don't understand yet?
It's very strange, you know, but you do hear these stories. And I think it's sure there may be plausible explanations for some of these. But, you know, at times people are, you know, like you'd said, Jim, they don't seem to be going out looking for attention, you know, or trying to get, you know, anybody's, you know, trying to get money or anything like that, you know, and if anything, you're going to lose credibility if you go out there and put your name behind a story like this, and yet people do come forward with these stories. It's truly very fascinating to me. What is behind them? Who knows? But boy, they're entertaining, though, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Now, that was a more recent one. One that's in the book, which actually is the first story in the book that I really love, actually comes by way of us from the United Kingdom. And that's one of the things I love about doing the podcast is the fact that we can have people all over the world. I've had people from Japan come on the show and tell a story. So that's a lot of fun. This was a story about a gentleman who called in and talked about his mother-in-law, who was at the National Health, one of the hospitals there in England, and she had been, you know, had quite a few health issues and bounced in and out of the hospital. And he said that his mother-in-law was kind of spooky. She always kind of had strange things happening to her, one of those people I talked about earlier. And anyway, what happened was one night she was in her bed in the hospital, and a nurse came around and talked for a few minutes and asked her if she was okay and asked her if she wanted a cup of tea. And this gentleman's mother-in-law said yes. The woman went away, and while she was away, the woman pondered. She said, there's something off about that woman. I can't figure out what it was. And she didn't come back with the tea until an hour later. And then she realized, and this is fairly recently in the last several years, that this nurse was wearing old school nurse garb, like the old hat that you'll see in movies and so forth. The, you know, the prim and proper kind of dress, maybe as opposed to the scrubs and things that they wear now.
Yeah.
But she didn't think anything of it. She took the tea. That was that. But she did keep it in her mind. And she had asked the nurse, what's the deal with the old uniform? And the nurse just smiled and left. So after a while, she started to think on this, and she was convinced she saw some kind of ghost. So she actually sees psychics a lot. So she met with a psychic, and this psychic said that he was getting a name. The name was Lily. So the next time the mother went to the hospital, she talked to one of the staff members and said, is there somebody, you know, who meets this description, maybe comes around and talks to the patients, one of the nurses, maybe she wears older style garments? She's like, oh, no, there's no one like that.
Huh.
She said, but I know who you met. You met Lily. That's the resident ghost.
You got to love it when that happens. How often do you hear stories like that, Jim?
You know, we do a show every week. I have probably four stories a week. I tend to let people talk. I let them tell their story in full. So a couple hundred stories a year. and now, you know, granted, some are more impactful than others. Some of the more impactful ones for me are, you know, those are kind of spooky, yooky stories. There's some very poignant stories as well. We just... well, this is actually from the book as well. There's this young lady who told a story about, I called it after the old, the really old song that some people may remember, Love is Like a Butterfly.
Oh, yeah.
And the idea of the story was this. This young lady, she was in her late teens, early 20s. She worked at the family car dealership. And this is in the 90s. And her job was to go out every morning and make sure that the cars weren't vandalized or anything, just make sure everything was buttoned up. So anyway, for whatever reason, she found a dead butterfly on the ground that was dying. And it wasn't dead yet, but it was dying. And she picked it up, and she said she'd never been into butterflies or anything like that. But this touched her for some reason, and she started crying. She went in back into the office where her mom was and brought the butterfly, and her mom was trying to quiet her down, had no idea because her daughter wasn't like this at all, and she was trying to calm her down. Well, while all this was happening, the phone rang, and it was this girl's grandmother saying that the ambulance was coming to her house to pick up her, the grandfather, because he thought he was dying. Now, they didn't think much of this because he had been through some health bouts before, so they just assume, oh, it's Grandpa having an episode again. You know, everything will work out. The mother said, you know, I'll go ahead on. Will you be okay here? And she said, fine. And the mother said, I'll call you if I need you. So they thought everything was going to be okay. Not after long, 45 minutes or so, her mom called and said, you need to come on up here. And because obviously the grandfather was not doing so well. And so she left. She said she almost ran every red light. She really tried to get through, tried to get to her grandfather. And she just did get there in time to see him take his last breath. But here's the kicker. After he passed on, everybody went back to the house. And as you know, the Southern tradition is to everybody starts immediately bringing in tons of food. She was very upset. She went in her room. She didn't want anything to eat. And then finally she said, you know, I have to get away. So she went for a drive in the country kind of aimlessly. And I'm going to read this exactly as it is because I think this is really cool.
Sure.
And she said, and while I was driving, I saw a little pond alongside the road. I pulled over, got out, and sat by the pond. I could never find this place again. It was just one of those places by the road. I was sitting there, and this huge swarm of tiger butterflies were everywhere. There were 20 or 30 of them. They were in my hair. They were on my shoulders. They were on the grass at my feet. They were by the pond. They were everywhere. And she says, goes on to say, usually when you see them, they might be passing by in the breezes and migrate on. But all of a sudden, I was surrounded by them, and they were in my hair and on my shoulder. And then they just took off. It was just magical. In that situation, you just kind of sit there and think, did that really happen? It was so fast, but it felt like forever when they were touching me, and then they were gone. To this day, and I've told my mother this story, it's kind of a bond we now have. If I'm having a bad day, or if my mother's having a bad day, a little tiger butterfly or a little yellow butterfly will go by on a day when you need to see it. And I kid you not, it could be the dead of winter when there's no bud outside anywhere. It was the most bizarre thing in the world. That day, Papa was communicating with me. I believe that. I honestly do. I always believe that. That was Beth. And she's actually from not South, but North Carolina. But a great story, I think.
Oh, really? Well, you know, we're from North Carolina. Yeah.
There you go.
Wow,
there
interesting. A little bit of synchronicity. And, of course, I think that that story really has all to do with synchronicity. Fascinating stuff. You know, and what is it about the occurrences, the way that they tend to kind of line up or even maybe more appropriately pile up, you know, when they seem to, you know, kind of mean the most like that?
I do, and it's something that interested me because before I really started to get into this, I always assumed, and I think many people who don't study it assume that when you talk about after-death communication, that means that a ghost walks up to you and says hello. But there, and I had a show years ago with PMH Atwater, I believe it was, and she has a great book, an encyclopedia of after-death communication, I believe it is. Mm-hmm. And nevertheless, there are many different ways that the dead, ones who have passed on, can try to communicate. Now, I may not have this story exactly right. I think of the scenario where a man had a he was on campfire. This isn't in the book, but he had a radio and he worked at a construction site, and it shorted out because of rain or something, and he brought it in and set it on the kitchen counter, and it wasn't playing. And then the next day or so, they're sitting around talking about his late sister. Now, a couple things you should know about his sister is she was a musician. She particularly liked to play the piano and sing the music of the great musician Carole King. And one of her favorite songs was So Far Away, if you're familiar with that song.
Yeah.
So anyway, they're sitting there with this radio that they assume is dead, and they're talking about her sister just coincidentally, and the radio comes on, and what is the song that's playing? So Far Away by Carole King. And I had something actually very, and it's in the book, happened very similar with my late brother, with a scenario kind of like that. So I believe that they try to get a message to us if they want to, and they may use any number of ways to do that.
What do you think about electronic voice phenomena, EVP?
I'm open-minded about it. I think sometimes there's a little bit of what is it when you see an ink blot and you pareidolia,
yeah,
or whatever that's called when you interpret something. I think sometimes we can say, "Oh, I think that he was saying get out," you know.
Yeah.
but I do think that there could be something to it. I've always been interested in things like the stone tape theory, which I'm sure you're familiar with, the idea that a place can be charged, and when we see phenomena and we hear phenomena, sometimes it may be due to just some kind of imprint that's been left. I don't know, but I'm open-minded to it, as I am with most of these things. Kind of my personal philosophy of the paranormal, and this is what I've stated on the show for years, is that my assumption is the great majority of things are thought to be paranormal are not. That they're probably explicable. But what I say is, heck, if 98% of everything that's thought to be paranormal is not, and it's explicable, well, that 2%, that represents a lot of actual cases. And I had this discussion on the Paranormal Podcast with the famous skeptic Michael Shermer.
Ah,
and actually, who would seem to be a very nice guy.
Yeah.
Although I totally disagree with
them.
And, but I don't, but the thing is I don't totally disagree with them. I think here's my problem with the quote skeptics.
Sure.
Is that they want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. They want to say, well, this is a fake. This is a hoax. This is a fake. This is somebody who saw the planet Venus. Therefore, it's all garbage. I think you can say, this is a fake, this is a fake, someone saw the planet Venus, someone was having a nightmare, and, oh, this sixth case over here, there might be something to that.
Right.
And that's the difference. So I think that there's room, and you're proof of it, and there are a lot of good people out there that are proof of it. I think of people like Jeff Belanger. You can be intelligent and still have an abiding interest and belief that there's something more to life than just what you can measure on a scale or in a test tube.
That's right. Well, I agree wholeheartedly. You know, at your website it says, you know, that you won't dress up in an alien costume. You aren't going to buy that $19.99 super official ghost detector off late night TV. But you believe that there's more to life than what meets the eye. And I'll tell you what I do believe, Jim, is that I don't think that that we have to justify everything based on our preconceptions of what is or is not. And I see, unfortunately, both sides do that. The believers believe, and therefore they justify everything based
exactly
on that belief. But the skeptics, the so-called skeptics, I say, or the pseudo-skeptics, they go into it with the very same sort of preconception,
yes,
that they can prove everything is you know, bunk. And they do that, whether or not it can be scientifically or otherwise proven as being, you know, misidentification of this or that. I think that we really, truly, in the spirit of being open-minded, in the spirit of true skepticism, we can't really always commit to knowing, because sometimes part of the process of inquiry is going to be accepting that we don't always know what's going on.
Well, a perfect example. One thing that I do at my site is most weekdays I'll put three or four stories up that are either paranormal stories or they're related. They're science stories that are somehow related. And just last week from the University of Melbourne, there's some physicists who are actually going to totally rewrite the Big Bang Theory, totally change it, saying the Big Bang Theory is wrong. These are well-known, respected scientists. And this is my point. I applaud science. Without science, we would not be doing this show right now. So believe me, I love science.
Indeed.
But I do not love the opinion that, oh, we've got it all figured out, because guess what? Now it's coming out that maybe the Big Bang Theory is wrong. So what else is wrong? I mean, scientists 200 years ago thought they were the key, a cat's meow, and knew everything. And now, to some extent, we laugh at, you know, if you think about medicine, the use of leeches. You know, we have to be humble enough to realize, yes, we should try to use our intellect to find these mysteries of the universe and to explain things. But I don't think we should ever be so enamored with our intelligence that we've got it figured all out. On the other hand, I I'll say this, and this is just my opinion. One of the things that make me more angry than the skeptics are the hoaxers on, quote, our side.
Yes.
When you look at the UFO videos that are faked, and you look at the Bigfoot videos. I mean, I don't know if you saw the story in the news just the other day. Somebody was killed trying to dress up like Sasquatch.
Oh, yeah.
It's idiocy. So, I mean, I'm thankful there's people like you, and there's a lot of your listeners out there who are level-minded people who really think that there's something to all of this. So let's seriously investigate it and keep our heads about it.
Not treat it like a joke. You know, actually, just,
exactly.
Just before we had you on the program tonight, we had, you know, talked about that. You know, we often will take a lighthearted approach to things on this program.
Sure.
But, you know, we do take the subject matter seriously. No matter how much kidding you'll ever hear from anyone in this studio, we do take this stuff seriously. And we refer to this incident in Montana where this gentleman was literally run over. He was hit by two cars. Trying to hoax a Bigfoot, you know, sighting, if you will. It was tragic. And the reason it's tragic is obviously there was a loss of life that could have been avoided had this person not been trying to go to extreme lengths just to fool people and to exploit the gullible believers or the so-called gullible believers. I don't think that everyone who claims that they have seen or believe in a creature like Bigfoot is gullible by any means.
I agree. I agree with you fully. And that's what frustrates me because let's say in a given year, and I have no idea what the number is. Let's say that 700 reports Bigfoot sightings in a year in the United States. I don't know what the number is, but let's just say. And let's say 600 of those are people like this guy dressing up in a costume. What about those other 100 or if it's 20 or 50 people who really saw something weird that was really interesting? It totally obscures what might be some very good evidence and some very good leads to follow.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I often think that there is something going on when it comes to stories of Bigfoot. You know, I couldn't tell you exactly
sure.
what it is, but it seems that, you know, there are enough credible stories. I mean, Jim, there are people who have signed affidavits and have gone on the record and said, you know,
absolutely,
there is clearly something that I witnessed that was not quite human, but close enough to where it was startling.
And if you think about the thing about Bigfoot, because people will go, you actually believe in Bigfoot? Well, let's think about this. Let's think about the news reports. Almost any week, you can see a report of a new species that's been discovered.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes it's beneath the sea. Sometimes it's in the rainforest. Who is to say that there couldn't be? Now, also, obviously, there are those reports or ideas that Bigfoot could be multidimensional. And that's why we've never found a carcass, for example. But I definitely think it, and I didn't mean to get off on a tangent there, but I just get a little angry at the fakers and the hoaxers because it hurts those of us like you and your team there who want to take this stuff seriously.
Well, I was going to say, Jim, if that's a tangent, then it was well worth it. You know, I like to say, in fact, time well wasted. And it's not wasted time at all. In fact, I appreciate your insights on that sort of thing. Jim, what else is going on with your own research and your own endeavors right now?
Well, a couple of things. I have my jimherald.com site. Again, I think we have about 300 we've produced about 370 podcasts between Paranormal Podcast and Campfire. I've had a new endeavor for the last year and a half, my Plus Club, and that's where we have membership and folks can sign up in there. I do a separate UFO show. I do a true crime show, a conspiracy show, and a spirituality show, and we do courses over there. That's over at jimherald.net. But if people haven't checked out what I do, really the starting place, the best place to go is jimherald.com because that's where the shows live. A couple things that we're going to be doing. One is actually another extension of the campfire concept is I'm going to go back through the archives over the last 3.5 years and re-interview the best experiencers, the best stories, and actually create a video series on YouTube of those. So that'll be kind of fun. I'm really excited about that. Other things that are going on, I am considering a marathon on Halloween, a video broadcast.
Oh, yeah.
And that'll be something over at jimherald.com as well. So there's actually quite a bit going on and also working on another writing project, but that'll be a little bit down the road.
Sounds like you've got your hands full, but that's a good thing, of course, especially if it has Jim Harold's name on it. You can find out more about him at jimherald.com. And, of course, he is host of the Paranormal Podcast. You can download those each week from his website, jimherald.com. Jim, anything else you'd like to leave with us before we turn you loose this evening?
Well, I just want to say, everybody, keep out there. Keep listening. Keep looking. If you've got any experiences, come over at jimherald.com. Sign on a campfire sign up at the top of the page, and I'd be glad to have you on the show and have you share an experience. And Micah, we've got to get you back on one of my shows again.
Hey, anytime, Jim. It's always my pleasure. And of course, as always, thank you for coming on the Grayling Report with us tonight. Jim, it's always great to talk to you. And anytime, my friend, if you ever need anything, you know how to find a reach out and find a helping hand, okay?
Will do. Thank you, sir.
It's been our pleasure. Jim Herald, ladies and gentlemen, check him out again. And, of course, we'll have him back on the show again sometime very soon. That wraps up our interview with Jim Herald tonight. When we come back, more weird news, strangeness, and, of course, a bit of information about missing pigeons. Now, what's going on with this? Well, we always like to feature these strange bird stories, sort of Hitchcockian. I think I've referred to them before in the past, and hopefully this will be something that you'll find interesting, if not a little frightening. We certainly did. Where are these pigeons going? And, of course, we've also got new reports of other things. Time differentials, reflective surfaces that seem to harness parallel pathways to other dimensions. And finally, of course, Nick Redfern's words of wisdom to ufologists. All to come here on the Grayling Report.
Welcome back to Science Today, and the next caller is 9-year-old Philip.
Hi, well, I know the molecular formula for glucose, C6H12O6, and the general formula for an alkene is CnH2n+2, but I can't seem to find any scientific formula for Bob.
Bob?
My goldfish.
Are you ready for kids who eat healthy? Good nutrition can lead to great things. To find out how a healthy lifestyle can help your child succeed, go to mypyramid.gov. Brought to you by the Ad Council and USDA.
Back to the program. It is the Grayling Report. We just wrapped up our conversation with Mr. Jim Herald of the Paranormal Podcast. You know, I always love talking with Jim because, frankly, in addition to being an open-minded researcher, Jim Herald is also someone who I think is a good storyteller, obviously. I don't think that has to be said a whole lot. And what I love about Jim is that when he comes on the program, or if you're listening to his program, you can just kind of kick back and enjoy. And it's been a very busy, stressful week for those of us here at Grayling International. And so we were probably, I would say, badly in need of being able just to kick back and enjoy some good stories. So thanks to Jim Herald of the Paranormal Podcast for joining us tonight to provide that kind of much-needed departure from daily life. And that said, when it comes to departures from daily life, you know, we've talked about a lot of strange things. I want to direct people's attention over to our friends at the Who Forted blog. This one wasn't our friend Greg Newkirk, but this was Josh Sanofsky. I hope I'm pronouncing his name properly. Everyone who listens to this program knows how articulate I am when it comes to pronouncing people's names. but there's a very interesting article I want to... we're going to have this in the show notes. I want to direct people's attention to over at the Who Forted blog. It's called A Time for Reflection, Mirrors in Folklore and Superstition. And as opposed to really digging into it right now, again, I want to just kind of send it over to people. Or rather, put it in the show notes so that people will go take a look at it themselves. And because, you know, I've been fascinated for a long time with mirrors and what parallels mirrors seem to hold for the paranormal, okay? Mirrors are indeed something that, you know, are kind of par for the course when it comes to ghosts and hauntings, if you think about it. Think about the legends of Bloody Mary. Think about the stories like I talked about in my book, Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule, where we talk about the psychomantium, you know, or the haunt box, you know, someone who literally can look into a mirror, and in the right circumstances, they enter an altered state where they literally will have communication with deceased loved ones from beyond the grave. these sorts of things. There are all these strange stories that are associated with mirrors. What is it about the reflective surface that is so interesting? You know, the ancient axiom that states that if you break a mirror, it's 7 years bad luck. You know, that actually goes back to ancient Rome, because it was believed that the human life cycle continued and kind of repeated and replicated itself, if you will, every 7 years. In other words, a person was sort of reborn every 7 years. And the idea was that if a mirrored surface were broken, that a part of a person's soul, as reflected in that mirrored surface, was damaged, and therefore you break a mirror and 7 years of bad luck. So there are a lot of superstitions and things that are associated with mirrors. And I recall that there had been another story somewhere that I'd seen recently that dealt with this as well. And I'm certainly not the only one who draws this parallel between the strange and the unusual and mirrors. In fact, I believe our friend Red Pill Junkie has pointed out that it may have been Quetzalcoatl, the infamous god who in many of the circles is associated with the end of the Mayan calendar, of course, that we're anticipating this December. One interpretation of that deity's name apparently, it may not have been Quetzalcoatl. I may not have my facts entirely straight on this, but I know it was one of those Middle American gods. I think RPJ could probably straighten us out on that here, if he likes. But the point is that this character was known as the god of the smoky mirror. Okay, again, this reference to these mirrors and the like. And in fact, Cortez also, allegedly from that very part of the world, brought back a black obsidian mirror, which was given to none other than John Dee. And John Dee, of course, utilized this mirror for purposes of scrying, which is something that we've talked about in the past on the program just as well. So often, okay, yes, RPJ in the chat room has actually said, I'm going to try and pronounce this, Tezcatlipoca was the god who had actually been referred to as the god of the smoky mirror. But again, it's that reference to these mirrored surfaces and what relevance they may have to strange phenomena. That's always something that has interested me. And so we'll have that linked in the show notes just as well for people to take a look at. Of other certain interest, though, is this story I've talked about a few times already, the mystery of the pigeon fancier's Bermuda Triangle. We couldn't make this stuff up. It is a mystery. The pigeon fanciers have likened to the riddle of the Bermuda Triangle, but this time the setting is a rural corner of northeast England. And on a map, you can see this. It begins northward by a town called Consett, and it heads as far south as Wetherby. Indeed, there is what appears to be a triangle of land in which people are claiming that pigeons are going missing. This is very strange. What is it about birds? Is it the way that electromagnetic fluxes and geomagnetic storms and things like that seem to affect animals? Carrier pigeons, of course, key among those which have homing abilities that can be affected by subtle changes in weather and sunspot activity and things like this. Well, whatever the case may be, apparently there are hundreds of racing birds that have disappeared in unexplained circumstances after being released into this aforementioned region. Experts are baffled at the phenomenon, with abnormally high rainfall, high levels of solar activity, and even signals from a spy base being blamed. Can you believe that? A spy base. Pigeon fanciers have compared it to the disappearance of ships and aircraft in an area off the Atlantic, of course bounded by Miami, Bermuda, and Puerto Rico, famously known as the Bermuda Triangle. But this mystery centers, the one in England that we're talking about here, it centers on a geographical area encompassing Thirsk, Wetherby, and Consett. Now, in the latest episode, about 13 out of 232 birds released in Thirsk last Saturday by a Scottish pigeon racing club made it back to the Scottish borders. Keith Simpson of the East Cleveland Federation of Pigeon Fanciers said racers across the region had suffered huge losses since the season started in April, with apparently many losing more than half of their birds. But where are they going? Some are considering stopping flying them until they establish why so many failed to return. Scottish pigeon racer Austin Lindoris said that when they fly down to Thirsk, Wetherby, and Consett, that area, we call it the Bermuda Triangle, because something always seems to happen. This isn't the first time that this has happened in that area, and I won't be racing there again, Austin says. And the latest problem to hit the world of pigeon fancying, some 60,000 people are thought to keep the birds, including 42,000 who race them. But the numbers are in steep decline, and there are fears that the pastime could become, well, extinct within a decade. That or the birds themselves may become extinct if they don't stop disappearing. What is it that causes these birds to disappear so mysteriously? It's a little disconcerting because, of course, we've seen strange drops in the numbers of populations of honeybees and other things like this. We've seen fish behaving erratically. And I'll tell you, what I'm concerned about is maybe signals from cell phone towers, things like that, Wi-Fi, internet. Now, granted, Wi-Fi is fairly localized, and it's not going to be the kind of thing that would affect, you know, affect fish out in a lake or in an ocean. But nonetheless, this sort of thing does happen, and there are obviously certain factors that are affecting the physiology of these animals in such a way that they become very disoriented and they may even die. Everything from high-altitude hypoxia to other different kinds of known natural conditions have been supposed as explanations for the deaths of these animals, especially the pigeons and other bird varieties that appear in these circumstances to become disoriented or just disappear altogether. But what's really going on? You know, who knows? It's really not very comforting. We're almost out of time. And during the last 10 minutes of this week's program, you know, we used to often feature a top 10 with our engineer, Mr. Matthew Oakley. We hadn't done one of those in a long time. And so I've got a top 10 of my own that I had to I had to feature on here. This one actually has a little bit to do with me. This was featured at the infamous website known as Nick Redfern's World of Whatever. Okay.
Do you like what I did with the board there?
Yeah, that was an incredible echo effect, Matt. By the way, I want to give Chris real quick before we get into this. I want to give Chris, who has hardly said two words tonight because I've been running my mouth, I want to give you a moment just to say hi. Yes, go ahead.
Hello, everyone. How are you doing tonight? It's Tuesday for me. It could be Thursday for you, depending on when you download the show.
Well, hello, Chris.
Regardless, I hope your weekday or weekend, whatever, is great.
Thank you. That was very nice. That was a very cordial, greeting that you passed along there.
Is there anything on your mind in the past week since we did the show, Chris?
I mean, there's all kinds of things on my mind.
Anything
none of them
that
are really like
to the show?
I mean, none of them are really that interesting, really, to anyone but me. So no.
Well, give us a taste of just one.
Just one.
Well, if you want,
just one.
I found out pumice stones used to clean flat grills are also very good at sharpening single-edged razor blades used in scrapers, thereby eliminating the need to keep changing out the blade when you're scraping grease off of an old piece of restaurant equipment. You can just revitalize the blade.
He's referring, of course, to the large kitchen we have here in the bunker.
Yeah.
See, I told you, not very interesting at all.
Everyday wisdom with Chris Hayes. I like that. That's going to be the new weekly segment. I wish I could have gotten Nick Redfern to come on and comment on this article. This is one of the best things I've seen in a long time. It's a little explicit at times. We'll link it in the show notes, and we're going to give you a paraphrased, abbreviated version at present. My dear friend, mi amigo, mi compadre, in the chat room, Mr. Red Pill Junkie, of course, he unfortunately had to attribute one of these top 10 things that ufologists should not do. He had to call me out he called me out right there in the comments section. But you know, that's what we friends in these ufological and research circles do. We knock each other around, but it's all in good fun. So Nick Redfern penned this article at Nick Redfern's World of Whatever, ever. And the article is titled "Ufologists Do Not Do These Things." Report.
Do
not report filed by. It didn't. It's not titled "Report Filed by Nick Redfern." I'm saying that just for fun and for effect. But I think I'm going to do this in the Sam Kinison voice. Ufologists, do not do these things! Ever! Don't do these things. Now, not too long ago, Nick writes, I wrote a top 10 themed post on one of the most ridiculous things in the field of Fortiana. What is it? the absolute pile of crap that currently passes for paranormal-themed reality TV. That's what. I love Nick because Nick just, you know, he's no holds bars. And I'll tell you this, too. Nick and I, we've been working together, you know, bit by bit, little by little, in correspondences mostly. We've been offered a number of television programs, he and I, over the last few months. And to date, I've turned every one of them down because each one is essentially this sort of reality TV-based crap that he's talking about. I don't want to offend anybody. I'm just going to put it all out there. Now, granted, there are a couple of people I've spoken with. You know, there are some people who I've been incredibly impressed with. I'll tell you, there have been producers who've contacted me from True TV who are, you know, in all my experience working in television, they've been the exception to the rule. Conspiracy theory and television programs like that, those people are so knowledgeable in their field of research. I mean, I kid you not, truly. I've been very impressed by them. But for the most part, you know, I'm not really impressed by television as it pertains to the paranormal. And Nick has expressed that same sort of thing. And so he thought he would do the same thing and dish on ufology in general. And he has listed here the top 10 things that if you were going to study UFOs seriously, here are the top 10 things you don't do. Number one, the mysterious middle initial. And what he's talking about here is don't use your middle. Can you reach over there and grab a copy of Magic Mysticism and the Molecule, Matt? Let's see if I've broken the fundamental rule here.
Is that the one written by Micah A. Hanks?
Yes, yes, indeed. Yes, apparently I have my middle initial right there. There's a box right there next to you that's full of them, Matt. It's okay. You don't have to get it. We all know my middle initial appears on the cover of that book. Here we go. All right. Yeah, he's almost got it. Okay. Yeah, just pull that open. There you go.
He opens the box.
Well, the thing is...
he's opened the box!
We all know your middle initial is A, but I've never known what that A stands for.
I'm going to leave...
Tell us on air.
Yes. I'm going to have to leave
Alphonse.
That. But you know what's even more interesting is that if you notice right here, Micah A. Hanks, and then right underneath that it says, forward by Nick Redfern.
I bet he was just beating the hell out of his keyboard when he wrote that, because he knew his name was going to be under someone who used a middle initial.
Yeah, and he knew that I was going to talk about him on this program tonight, too, I'm sure. And like I said, this is all in good fun. Nick and I are good buddies. The next thing you do is the letters after the name. Rather, you don't do that. It doesn't matter if you're a PhD, an MD, or anything else. Don't put that after your name! It's not going to increase your credibility in ufological circles. If you're writing about UFOs, nobody's going to believe you anyway. Okay? Three, the ufological dress code. Quite possibly the one thing that is guaranteed to make me spit venom and my head spin all the way around while speaking in ancient and terrible tongues. Nick writes, he says, the theory that the black suit plus crisp tie and white shirt, or red tie and shiny black shoes, will somehow make the relevant researcher and their attendant message more credible. Nothing you wear will ever improve your position as a ufologist in the eyes of the bigger world outside. The only thing which can ever achieve that is the discovery and presentation of hard physical evidence of the UFO phenomenon. And if that happens, it matters not a bit if me... Or rather, if, like me, you like to wear t-shirts and jeans, Nick does, famously. Or if you just get decked out like a posh waiter or someone who runs a funeral home. Ufologists, don't do it. Number four, don't say the right thing to the allegedly influential people. Oh my gosh, I loved your book and I totally believe that aliens are coming to Earth and abducting human beings when in fact you don't. Don't just suck up when you're around the big guys. Be an individual. Put your thoughts out there. Be an individual like Chris the Milkman Hayes right here.
Oh, yeah, I don't kowtow to anyone.
That's right.
Not to Micah A. Hanks, not to George Q. Norrie, and not to Giorgio M. Tsoukalos.
That's right. We have respect for all researchers, but we will bow to none. Because you know what? Each man must learn to be sacred and individual unto himself. And yes, Nick is right. Don't just worry about saying... He says, no. I've seen it time and time again at UFO conferences. And no doubt I'll continue to see it for some time again. It's the ufological equivalent of letting the boss win a game of golf. Which nobody should be doing either, by the way. Seeking out people in ufology who you think can best help advance your career... And then saying what you think they will want to hear. You know, in the foreword that Nick wrote for my book. And granted, a lot of people in these circles, you know, we correspond via email and we've never actually met. But Nick and I, we've hung out, we've drank together, we've partied together. Yes, we actually do know each other. And Nick's going to be at Paradigm Symposium this year. I'm looking forward to seeing him again. very soon. But, you know, he points out in the foreword to this book, enjoy this book. Digest its contents carefully, and above all else, learn. And before I forget, throw out your bulging, aged, and yellowing files and reports. They're now as extinct and redundant as a T-Rex. And the reason he says that is because, you know what? We can't continue just to substantiate the old claims. We've got to get a little innovative with this ourselves. You know, think and act, and most importantly, speak unto yourself. Don't worry about trying to impress other people. The fifth thing he lists, he says, creating an image of don't talk to me. I'm a famous ufologist. I'm sorry. If you're a ufologist, folks, you're probably as far from famous as you'll ever get. And therefore, you are not the kind of person who can stand around at a conference and not talk to other people. When we see you, my friends, at Paradigm Symposium this year, please come up and talk to Chris and Matt and I. We will look forward to that conversation. Number six, the truth is coming. What truth? You know, Project Blue Book was chasing this phenomena back in the 1940s. How much more do we know about UFOs today than we really, truly knew back in the 1940s? A lot of people would argue we do know a lot more. I would not. Number seven, it's ET forever. This is a big one for me. For reasons I have never been able to fathom, there seems to be an underlying rule in much of ufology. Thou shalt not be changed or alter or modify thy views. Well, I've never gotten that one, Nick says. In the same way that today I don't watch the same TV shows or read the same books as I did when I was a little kid. Why should I? Or any of us in ufology be expected to hang on to old, outmoded, and outdated theories and beliefs in light of new ideas, themes, and paradigms? So I'll tell you why. Because it's expected. It's expected because the old school wants the old ways, the old beliefs to be upheld. But all that happens is they become, well, old. It's almost like she's the abduction researcher who thinks it's aliens. He's the guy that believes it's Roswell and that they were time travelers. Or she's the person who writes about UFOs being interdimensional. And he's the one that tells us it's Venetians, etc., etc. Blah, blah. I think it's kind of, well, like some, what?
Wait, Venetians have this kind of technology?
Yes, yes. The ones over there near Italy.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I must have meant blinds, Venetians.
Blinds and UFOs? What can't they do?
Venusians.
Oh, Venusians. Okay. People from Venus. But doesn't it rain acid on Venus?
Yes, it probably does.
Man, that must be one hell of a party.
They've got really, really, really tough skin. They're like reptilians on Venetia. Number eight, never turning off the I'm a ufologist switch. I'll just put it to you like this. I love this one. Nick says, droning on about UFOs all night, A, will demonstrate your lack of a life, B, fail to get you laid, and C, quite possibly, see you on the receiving end of a powerful punch on the jaw from someone who cannot take another 3 hours of waffle about memory metal found in the New Mexico desert 60-something years ago. When it comes to being stuck like an old and scratchy vinyl album, ufologists don't do it. Number nine, Bigfoot. We talked about Bigfoot a bit on the program tonight. And as someone who has done far more cryptozoological research than UFO research, Nick says, I like to throw out stories of Bigfoot appearances in conjunction with stories of UFO appearances, because what does it do? It ruffles the feathers of the UFO people, the UFO believers, I guess, who want to believe, not that we are dealing with some sort of a phenomena that we know virtually nothing about still, decades after the fact, but instead something that we'd like to hopefully, I can't talk tonight. Hopefully hoping that this is something extraterrestrial. This is something that that troubles these sorts of people. And we have to, again, challenge ourselves. There's nothing wrong with doing so. For those fearful of what their peers might think, however, it is a problem. And so they stay weak and silent, Nick says. And then finally, number 10, ufological worries. He says, for all their desires to spread the ufological word at their conferences on TV, on radio, on the net, I've seen more than a few ufologists squirm and go bright red when they are forced to answer people outside of their field the question of, so what do you do? Again, this is due to a lack of self-worth, lack of character, lack of self-belief, etc. Of course, people are going to laugh a bit, maybe a lot, when you say, I look for aliens. But instead of avoiding discussion, say it out loud and say it proud. If you think the best thing to say about your beliefs is to say nothing at all, well, I can only add four words. And one at a time. Ufologist, don't do it. That was a funny article, and we enjoyed it. But you know, he's very right, and therefore we're giving Nick Redfern the last word on this week's edition of the program. I'm Micah Hanks, and when we jump in there, Chris, go ahead. Oh, goodness. It's been a fantastic week. Thank you to Jim Harrell. Thank you to Nick Redfern, and of course, Chris Hayes, Matt Oakley, and all the fine folks associated with this program. I'm Micah Hanks, the Mouth of the South, and until next time, my friends, we'll speak to you soon. Stay strange.